wake up. There's no sleeping in on Saturday. It's time for the Paul Santos Show on WBSM. Join Paul as he tackles local issues, current events, and fun conversations. Call 508-996-0500 or send Paul an app chat message on the WBSM app. Hey, hey, hey. Now, here's Paul Santos. What you got to say?
All right, welcome back to hour number two of the Paul Santos Show. Don't forget Ken Pittman. He will be here at 9 o'clock from 9 to 12 here at WBSM. Thank you very much for listening in. Wanted to pick up on the question that that caller had right before I had to go to that break. I just barely got the commercials in. Got caught off guard. Sometimes that happens. We're in discussion and all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait a minute. Got to get those commercials in there. If it weren't for the commercials, there'd be no us. There'd be no you. So I got to make sure I stay on top of that. Yeah, I was talking about the First Amendment and desecration of flags and so forth. And at what point does that rise to the level where the First Amendment doesn't protect you? Well, I think if you're violent, if you commit an assault, if you're inciting a riot, you know, any of those types of situations would disqualify the protected speech. In other words, it wouldn't be protected speech. You'd be disqualified if it rose to the level of clear and present danger, assaultive behavior, inciting a riot. That's why they always use the thing, you know, the phrase, you can't say fire in a theater. Well, yeah, because that's not an opinion. Saying fire in a theater is not an opinion. You're basically saying something to try to incite people to have a stampede where people could get hurt. So that's not an opinion. But saying that, you know, you dislike Israeli people, you dislike black people, you dislike gay people, any kind of name the horrific offensive statement that you could make, you can make that statement. You have to protect it because protecting that statement is why we have the First Amendment, which is why we are different than other countries. And the founding fathers put that in there for a reason. Somebody might say, well, if that was another country, they'd shoot you. Well, that's what makes them the other country. That's what makes us America. That's what makes us different. Now, I think the caller had said, you know, being an attorney and so forth, what is it like representing someone who admits they're guilty, but then they plead not guilty? Well, there's a little bit to unpack there. Usually what happens is, in fact, it happens just about all the time. If someone is charged with a crime, and even if they admitted to the crime, at the arraignment, the judge doesn't let the person just enter a guilty plea right then and there willy-nilly. Because the judge and the court procedure, this is how it is in Massachusetts anyway, the court wants to make sure that the defendant, the person being charged with a crime, understands the process, knows what's going on, has a right to consult with an attorney to make sure that they understand the process. So it's almost impossible for somebody to walk in the first day of court at the arraignment and say, you know what, I'll just plead guilty. Unless it's like a minor misdemeanor and, you know, you're looking at a fine or something like that. But if it's something of significance, the court wouldn't accept the guilty plea anyway. The court is going to require that that person at least get one continuance date to speak to a court-appointed attorney or speak to someone and then come back and then enter the plea of guilty. That's the first thing. The second thing is, a lot of times what happens is people think that, you know, if you're a defense attorney and you're representing someone, that the only thing on the table is getting that person acquitted. But 90% of the time, that's not even the case. I would venture to say that like 90% of the time, unless you're dealing with a murder case, which I didn't do murder cases because I chose not to. I did motor vehicle homicides and things of that sort, but I never had any desire to get on the murder list. But anyway, you know, most of the time, something like 90% of the time, it's just the determination as to if someone's charged with multiple offenses, which one of the offenses are they guilty of, number one, and number two, what is the appropriate punishment? What's the appropriate sentence? So what happens most of the time is somebody's charged with, let's say, four counts, count A, B, C, and D. So you look at it and you say, wait a minute, you charge this person with count A, B, C, and D? Well, A and B I can see, but count C and D, you have no evidence whatsoever. So if you dump C and D, you know, my client will plead guilty to A and B. And now it's okay, so now what are we going to do? What's the sentence going to be? Well, is the sentence going to be a fine? Is the sentence going to be a suspended sentence? Is the sentence going to be probation? Is the sentence going to be a ankle monitor, home confinement? If the sentence is going to be a jail sentence, how long of a jail sentence is it going to be? If it even rises to the level of a jail sentence. But like in district court, 90% of the time you're talking not so much about whether the person did whatever the allegation is, but did they do it? Number one. Number two, whatever they did, which statutes did it violate? Did it violate this statute but not that one? Do you have the right statute? And then once you do, what's the penalty under that statute? And then what's the penalty going to be? So a lot of it is just looking at the case, negotiating the case, and coming up with a resolution that the prosecutor thinks is fair, that the judge thinks is fair, that you as the representing counsel thinks is fair. And that's usually how it's resolved. That's 90% of the time how it goes down. It's not so much that, you know, you see like on television, you know, they're saying, you did this, and the guy's saying, no, I didn't. Well, that happens too, you know. And so you look at the case and make a determination whether or not you think that the witnesses that the prosecution has are of great veracity or not, and whether or not the defense side has witnesses that say different than what the prosecution witnesses say. I mean, the Karen Reed case, I didn't watch that case very closely. People ask me all the time, did you watch the Karen Reed case? What'd you think about it? I'm like, the last thing I wanted to do was watch a case. But, you know, again, you know, there was a lot of arguments to be made that her witnesses were more persuasive than the government witnesses. And so you present that and then the jury decides. That's pretty much how it goes down. So anyway, that answers that question. But I do want to point out, too, I think that caller does make a point that, you know, these anti-Israel protests, pro-Palestinian protests, would they be looked at differently on a college campus if it was a white supremacist, pro-white supremacist protest? Well, you know, I think it would be. I think it would be. I don't, because I think that, you know, whatever the protest is, the protest should be protected. As long as there is no clear and present danger of any kind of violence or any kind of, you know, people being hurt. And then it gets a little bit difficult to unpack when a protest is in a public spot where people can easily be agitated, or as opposed to, you know, you making a statement, you know, on your own Facebook page, or, and again, Facebook has their own standards too. That's another thing. But let's say you make a statement, a public statement that's offensive, that's horrendous. And whether it's the desecration of the flag, which I would never want to see, do you think there should be an exception for that, for the American flag? Again, it's very difficult to defend something that's offensive, but I think we have to make every effort to defend something that's offensive, because that's what makes us different. That's what makes us special. What do you think? 508-996-0500. Hello, you are on the air.
Good morning, Paul.
Hi. Hey, good. How are you today? Good to hear from you. Good. Hey, before you go, I ran into John Robinson the other day. And I was like, oh, man, I haven't seen him in a long time, but it was a lot of fun. This is an old neighborhood person.
He's a great guy. He's an excellent musician, man, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, he loved playing the trumpet. He teaches. That's and, right. Yeah, he's still kicking like you and me.
Yeah, we are kicking. Sometimes barely, but kicking. Yeah. But I was going to say, on a slightly different note, but yet returning to laws, Ken Dryden died.
I just heard that on the news, and the first thing I thought of was, you know what I did? I just texted my brother.
I'll never forget that. For anybody who doesn't know, his brother Mark was a goaltender, and we played street hockey. And when Ken Dryden came out with that mask, it was the wildest-looking mask for a goaltender to have. And your brother made one, just like it.
Yeah, out of popsicle sticks.
Out of popsicle sticks.
Exactly. And it looked good. It looked just like the real thing.
It didn't matter if it worked or not. It looked fantastic. And, yeah, that was I didn't realize it, but Ken Dryden was in eight seasons of the NHL, and he won six Stanley Cups.
That's amazing. It was unbelievable. He was a money goaltender. Of course, he upset the Bruins in 1971 when the Bruins scored all kinds of records and everything like that, and they stunned the Bruins in that first round, and I could never stand him after that. But, you know, my dislike for him was just because he was on Montreal and they tortured the Bruins. But what a class guy. You know what I mean? He became an attorney, and he was very highly intellectual gentleman, and he did the color commentary during the Miracle on Ice series there with Al Michaels. You know, I always thought he was a great guy, but when he was playing for the Canadians, I could not stand him.
That's just the nature of the beast with that. But the guy was like, he was probably the tallest hockey player at that time ever. He was about 6'5", I think.
You know, and at that time, goaltenders were small. Now they're all getting bigger all the time. But back then, he was so big that he covered most of the net. And, you know, of course, he was on a great team, too, the Montreal Canadiens. But he was the guy that, you know, he could get hot and he could just shut you down. And he definitely frustrated the Bruins more than once.
Yeah, and everybody thinks just because you're big, it's that much easier. But you got to—that guy moved fast. And back then, only one or two goaltenders ever used the butterfly style. So even the stand-up goaltenders doing split saves, which were really tricky and hard, you know, very difficult type of goaltending to play. But he was a spectacle to watch, that's for sure.
You know, I was going to say that I sound like an old timer, but I actually like the way the goalies had to play then compared to now, because they all just do the same thing. They go into that butterfly, they fan out, and they go into that position in every single shot. And they didn't have to do all the splits and all that stuff that they used to have to do in the old days with those little skinny pads.
It was amazing to watch. You're absolutely right. All those low shots are so difficult to stop. And when you were a stand-up goaltender and you had to make those split saves to do it, it took a lot. It was an unbelievable, you know, athletic act to pull off. And the butterfly style definitely takes a fair amount of skill and a lot of different muscles. But anything high is harder for those guys to stop. You know, once you're down low, and you'll get a good percentage of the low shots, but the higher shots are really hard for those guys to stop.
I know street hockey you were like a big goal scorer, but did you ever play net in street hockey?
I did. I played net and in speed hockey, and I did a little bit in ice hockey. Now, so when the first ice hockey school came to New Bedford after the rink opened, it was run by two brothers, Bobby and Kevin Sheehan. They were from Scituate, Mass. One of them played for the California Golden Seals, which doesn't exist anymore, and the other one was an American Hockey League player. Well, I went down to watch the school because I couldn't afford to go. And the second day, I went there in the morning. And Kenny Trahan was running the school, and he said, "Hey Ron, you know our other goaltender didn't show up. Do you know where we can get another goaltender?" I said, "Hey, you're looking at him right here." So we went home. Of course, my brother Eric, who had all the goalie gear, didn't know I was upstairs stealing his gear for the day. And I went down, but I could not find his stick mitt. All I could find was a Kmart hockey glove. So I couldn't find the stick mitt. So I get down in the net, and they're doing warm-ups, and they're taking slap shots. And I'd go from left to right side of the net. Somebody would come down the right side of the ice, take a shot. Then I'd go to the left side, and someone would come down. And I looked, and Bobby Sheehan's coming down the left-hand side. He takes a slap shot on me. Who's a pro? I'm about 15 years old. He took a slap shot. All I saw was a black blur for a split second. And, it's going right for the Kmart glove. And I stopped it with the Kmart glove, shattered the glove and my hand at the same time. End of story.
Man. So you were injured? Did you have to go to the hospital?
No. I fractured a bone in it, but my hand doesn't look the same anymore. That thing was different. They wrapped my hand up and they gave me a glove to put on it. I finished the day out, but I was certainly hurting. It was just, I didn't think he would pull that off. They would never allow that to happen again today. Of course, but back then, again, things were different. And one of Gump Worsley's last games he played, I believe, he took us with like a minute left in the game. He took a slap shot to the head, out cold. They take him off the ice. They stitch him up. They give him a beer, and he comes out and he plays the last minute of the game.
Oh, yeah, I know. He was nuts, that guy, huh?
Those guys were. They were different animals, you know?
Hey, you know, my wife's maiden name is Worsley, you know? And oh, really? She's actually related to Gump Worsley by, you know, like second, third cousin type thing, you know?
Yeah, so
I always got a kick out of that because you don't see too many Worsleys around. But I said, you know, you ever heard of Gump Worsley? It's like, yeah, okay. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah, so that was a talking point when we first met, you know?
No kidding. That's wild. Yeah, that generation's gone, that's for sure. But, hey, always good to have you on, Paul.
All right, yeah, thank you very much for the call. All right, that gentleman is somebody that grew up in my neighborhood. And, you know, we talk about how things change. You know, kids play video games now and, you know, they're on social media and all that. Back then, of course, we didn't have any of that. So in our neighborhood, right, which would be a neighborhood that was in the northwest end of New Bedford, just south of Riccardi's, okay, just south of Hathaway Road in those areas there, Gardner Street, Roseanne Street, Pamela Drive and the like. And there were so many kids in the neighborhood that if we wanted to play a wiffle ball game, a baseball game, a street hockey game, we could get a game going in about 2 minutes. You know, we just call around real quick, or you just get up in the morning and walk down the street and it's like, hey, I hear there's a game going on down there, you know? And the next thing you know, there would be like, you know, kids all over the place playing street hockey. And then we got the nets. And like that caller said, you know, they didn't have the fancy gloves that goalies have now. I mean, you can still get them. And I guess you could have got them then. But basically, all you did was you took your baseball glove and you use that as the glove. I think my brother, he made like some kind of a pillow thing to make the stick mitt. And then we slapped together like, yeah, we got a couple of pillows from the bed, wrapped them around our legs and called those the goalie pads. And then you just made it work. You just made it work the way you had to be innovative back then, right? That's, I know our kids would probably say, ah, listen to the old timer talking about how the way it used to be. Well, that's the way it used to be. And actually, this kind of ties into something I brought up very, very early on during the first hour. You know, we lost a terrific gentleman, Steve Gaspar, a terrific coach and educator from the town of Dartmouth. So sad, at the age of 74, just passed away suddenly. I believe I heard that it was heart attack, but don't hold me to that. But just like that, you know, all of a sudden, boom, you know. And 74 isn't as old as it used to be. You know, we see a lot of people in their 70s, even into their 80s, just doing fantastic, you know. He was an athlete. He was in great shape. And many people looked up to him. And he was a great athlete. His kids all played ball. His daughter, Jessica, was a great ball player. Son, Tim, was a great player. Sarah and Jennifer, terrific kids that I know to some degree. And it's too bad that we lost him because he was a great guy. And, you know, they named the court after him. And it was just so sudden. And so I put the question out there, how different are things now than they were when you were growing up? Like, we're talking about street hockey, and the reason why that came up is because Ken Dryden, the great Montreal goaltender who just gave the Boston Bruins so much trouble throughout the 1970s, drove me crazy. And, of course, my brother loved the fact that, you know, he's a big Ken Dryden fan, and I respected him, and I liked him now that I look back at it. But at the time, I couldn't stand him, and I just wanted the Bruins to beat him that one time. They almost had him in the too many men on the ice game, but they came up short, and Ken Dryden just passed away at the age of 78. So we're going down, you know, memory lane here, talking about people that have passed, and, hey, you know, you never know when your number is going to come up. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, I hear you're talking about my team, the Montreal Canadiens.
Oh, no, not one of those. They only tortured us for an entire decade.
Oh, yeah, and I'm exactly your age, so I know what you're talking about. And I played street hockey, and I'm from Bay Haven, and the tennis courts down in Fort Phoenix, that's where I live, are the best place to play street hockey, right? Because you can use wood sticks in there without playing in the street itself, because the tennis court is nice and smooth. And what a place to play. We had roller pucks back then. You know, the pucks with the little balls on them.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yeah, the little balls on the puck. Yes.
Yeah, but the tennis court, the tennis court was the best place to play. We played every weekend down there. It was just, these guys came from New Bedford, and they'd play us every week, and we kicked their ass every time. You know, because those guys play ice hockey too, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, and inside of a tennis court, you had the fence too, right? So the ball or the puck wouldn't keep going out of play, right?
That's why it was perfect. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you can use a wooden stick in there because if you use a wooden stick on the street itself, it can tear it apart.
Yeah. Remember they had those plastic blades that you put on the end of the stick, and then you held them over the stove so that you could curve them.
Yeah, I bend them.
Yeah, you bend them.
I'm a left-hander.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a left-hander. I can never do right.
Yeah.
I'm a right-hander throwing my baseball and football, but I'm a lefty ice hockey player, hockey player in general. Yeah.
Well, that whole Sandlot game thing where kids would just have these pickup games. I mean, we had some awesome
every
pickup
day
games.
School.
You know?
Every day after school, baseball down at Rogers School.
Yeah.
In South Haven. We played baseball there all the time all summer. Kids don't do that. I don't see them playing anymore.
No. If you drove around New Bedford like in the 70s or 80s, there were kids everywhere playing hockey, baseball, football, wiffle ball, you name it. And, you know, that's all gone. The Sandlot game is gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, I had an invention with wiffle ball.
Uh-oh.
What you do is, I'll tell you, and you can hit the ball pretty far. You know those rags that you get, like a mechanic rag, those orange rags?
Yes.
Oh, just a face cloth.
Yes.
You stuff the ball. You stuff the wiffle ball with that, a cloth. The mechanic rag is better than a face cloth because it's a little more firmer. And it holds in there. And my God, the pitches I could throw with that thing. I could probably throw 60 miles an hour. Honest to God. And I had all kinds of curves and everything.
Yeah.
And eventually the ball gets softer. And then it starts to break. And then you have to get another wiffle ball. You know, but it would last the whole day.
Well, remember the wiffle balls, they would crack, right? So then we'd tape them. So we'd start out with the tape in one direction, then next thing you know, it would be an X, and the next thing you know, it would be another line. Next thing you know, the thing was like this heavy tape ball, you know?
Right.
And it wasn't wiffle ball anymore then, you know?
Sure, but to get some weight to the ball, you put the rag in it.
Yeah. That's I don't think we ever did that. I didn't hear that one. That's a new one.
Yeah, but that, honest to God, you could throw that damn thing 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I swear to God. And I had all kinds of pitches that I invented.
I'm sure you did.
Because, you know, if you just throw a regular wiffle ball with nothing in it, and you try to throw it hard, you can throw your arm out eventually.
Yeah, right.
But this way, you could throw that thing fast, and you could hit it far, too, if you got a hold of it. And but I have some trivia for you guys. Montreal Canadiens, their symbol, the big C on their shirt, on their jersey, that H in the middle. Do you know what that stands for?
I think I do. I think it's hockey.
No, habitant.
Oh, the habitant, les habitants. Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I should have known that. The Habs. They used to call them the Habs. Yeah.
Yeah, the Habs. And the habitant soup. That's what that is. It's a French soup.
Hey, you know, it's disappointing, not to get off on sports here, but as disappointing as 1971 was, the year of the too many men on the ice, oh, we had them. We had them. 3-1 in the third period. We had them. And we blew that damn game.
I know. Bruins had a great team back then. I'll tell you.
Oh, the lunch pail, Don Cherry. Oh, we had them. We had them, and we just couldn't get over the top, you know?
Phil Esposito, Bobby Orr. You kidding me?
I know.
I've been up to the Forum quite a few times to watch the Bruins up there.
That's one regret I have. I never made it to the Forum. That must have been great watching
the
game.
Oh, my God. It's crazy up there. It's crazy. And I had my Canadian jersey on, of course. And I watched the Chicago Blackhawks up there. Tony Esposito was the goaltender for Chicago. And I think it was a record shot on goal.
Mm-hmm.
It was 60-something shots each on goal. And I think it was a 6-6 tie, if I remember right. It was back in the early 70s. Yeah.
Nice. All right. Hey, thank you. I got to go to a break. Thank you very much for a trip down memory lane.
Bye-bye.
All right, if you're on the line, please stay on because I have to get to this break. 508-996-0500. The reason why we mention this discussion here is because Ken Dryden, the great Hall of Fame goaltender of the Montreal Canadiens, passed away at the age of 78. And Steve Gaspar, locally, great coach and somebody who's a great leader and an educator, passed away suddenly this week at the age of 74. So it's just like two sports people that are very recognizable And, of course, locally, the loss of Steve Gasper. Any memories of Steve Gasper or maybe somebody that passed that you want to talk about that influenced your life? One of the topics on the table here, 508-996-0500. Back in a moment, high temperature of 80 degrees. Can't beat that. Talking about a number of topics here, we lost Steve Gasper, great coach, great educator from the town of Dartmouth. Our condolences go out to the Gasper family for the loss of Steve, a real shocker. We're just kind of talking about his life and, you know, whether he influenced you, anybody out in the community, or whether you have a particular teacher. And then, while we were talking about that, the news came on, and there was an announcement that Hall of Fame hockey player Ken Dryden passed away at the age of 78. My brother Mark, who just texted me that he was listening, he was a big fan of Ken Dryden, and I really liked him, too. Afterwards, after he was done, I looked back and said, wow, that guy was unbelievable, right? Became an attorney like my brother and I, but the thing was, is when he was playing against the Bruins, I could not stand him because we couldn't beat him. And then that one year, seventh game, 1979, we had the lead 3-1 in the third period, and we just couldn't hang on the too many men on the ice game. It still hurts to this day. And the other disappointing day, of course, was the Bucky Dent game for the Red Sox. And the Bucky Dent game, where the Red Sox lost that playoff game to the Yankees, the Bucky Dent game and the too many men on the ice Bruins game, they happened within about 6 months of each other. So it was rough times back then. Since then, the Bruins finally won a cup. And, of course, the Red Sox have won a number of times. So things are a little bit different. And, by the way, I did want to mention to Ron Perry, who was somebody that grew up in my neighborhood. My brother does appreciate you recalling the popsicle stick Ken Dryden mask. My brother made a hockey mask that looked just like the Ken Dryden mask made out of popsicle sticks. And he certainly had a knack for doing things like that, things that I could never do, but he still gets a kick out of that popsicle stick mask. Anyway, if you'd like to get in on the discussion, 508-996-0500, any of the topics that I brought up or one of your own. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Paul. Yeah, that brings back memories. We used to play street hockey down at Riverside Park in Audible School and Phillips Avenue, down over there. Used to makeshift. Then we had a league down, deck hockey league, down in New Bedford High.
Oh, yeah, they had that deck. Yes, I remember that.
As a matter of fact, the guys, I remember, I played, and I just had a job. I couldn't break it. But the guys in that league, some of them, they actually formed a professional team that toured the United States, and they won the championship.
Oh, I didn't know that.
A couple of years in a row. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. It was great. But we had some teams from Woonsocket, Rhode Island, which kicked everybody's butts. They were really good. It was just organized and formed. And we used to make the goalie pads out of our mom's old couches, cushions.
Well, you know what we did? We took pillows, and we put them around from the knees down. And then we just took like strings or ropes and tied them around, and those were the pads, you know, from the knees down. So whatever you had to do, you did it. That was it, you know?
We just did it. As a matter of fact, I went by, I grew up in New Bedford, North End, but I just went by, I've gone. Years later, they never did anything, the city never did anything for us kids, for as far as like a hockey, street hockey, rink. We used to have to use the tennis courts and all that. Then a few years later, when I was growing up, they put a skate park just for a few kids to use, because the skate park was the thing. Mm-hmm. Out of cement. I don't know how many kids, but they did that, but they couldn't do it for hockey.
Yeah, we used to play on dead end streets, you know. There was a street up in the northwest end of New Bedford, Lantern Lane, right? So you go to the end of the street, there was a turnaround, you know, like a little cul-de-sac. And we would play down there, except that the person who owned the house at the end of the street didn't look too kindly upon it. So they actually called the cops on us a couple of times. But we were good kids. Well, we never really created any problems. It's just that, you know, when you get 25 kids playing a street hockey game at the end of the street, I guess if you're an adult, it can be a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, especially after school that night, played until till it's dark, even when it's dark. But anyway, that did bring back
great times. I'll tell you, great times, absolutely.
Yeah, great times, absolutely.
So you weren't a Montreal Canadiens fan, were you, by any chance?
No, but I was I was a big Bruins fan.
Me too.
Don Cherry did get fired that day. and he's a character. He's a national treasure. But you know, I don't know, Don Cherry. I don't know if you know what happened to him. They canceled him in Canada, kind of.
Yeah, I didn't hear a lot about it. But what exactly happened?
Well, I guess
he made some kind of comment.
They wear this. He made a comment.
Yeah,
they wear this. To do with the war, this red, I don't know the name, but it's a flower that they wear.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically was saying that troops died for this country, something, I think it was anti-woke.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure, but they used to wear, you know, his comment, he used to wear those crazy jacket.
Oh yeah,
very
right,
colorful
right.
Guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he was awesome.
He was a great coach too. He really was
great coach and
the lunch
great personality.
Team. Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
And after he made that comment, I forgot what was it about. Oh, some qualified.
You know, us old timers, we got to be careful what we say.
yes.
Sometimes we can blurt
exactly
something out.
Said.
We blurt something out that doesn't go as well as it would have years ago. You know.
Yeah, he did say something about it was anti woke at the time.
Yeah.
And they canceled them.
Yeah,
it was
that's
just
too
like,
bad. I don't believe people say that. People say that I'm probably a little bit more liberal than this audience, but I don't believe in people getting canceled for, you know, blurting out something that's unpopular or maybe even it was a mistake. You know, sometimes somebody says something and you go, yeah, you know what? I apologize. I shouldn't have said that. Oh, that's not enough. They want to hang you by the tentacles. You know what I mean? Like it's just too bad. You know what I mean? People make mistakes. They blurt out things they're not supposed to. I mean, get over it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, we become a country of chaos. I admit I stopped drinking Budweiser for a little bit, but I come to find out it was punishing a lot of American farmers, you know, making and I stopped. I said, you know, but I didn't, you know, I admit I stopped drinking it.
Hey, that's your right. That's your First Amendment right. All right, thanks for the call.
But I'm back. You got it.
All right, thank you very much for the call. Call again, 508-996-0500. Back in a moment with the Paul Santos Show. Ken Pittman, it will be here at 9. It will be a very nice 80 degrees. How about that? Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, you brought back a lot of memories, not necessarily good memories of Ken Dryden.
I know, huh?
As a Bruins fan, watching on the old T-Box TVs, Bobby Orr and Phil Esposito, Ken Hodge, Wayne Cashman.
Channel 38.
They threw everything at him but the kitchen sink. I think Ken Dryden was the most luckiest. But he played in a zone against the Bruins. It was just outrageous. And other teams, he would give up a lot of goals. But against the Bruins, it was something. You know,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he did play his best hockey against the Bruins. I mean, he had a couple of good years against the Flyers, too. But he won, like, I think that caller was right, 6 Stanley Cups in 8 years or something like that. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, he was good. But against the Bruins, Phil Esposito threw, it was like all his shots, and he blocked everyone. And somehow against the Bruins, what do you think made him so in a zone against the Bruins? It was like... It really cost us a lot of, it could cost us the championship or two.
You know, he wrote a book, right? And I think I read the book because, you know, I disliked him and my brother was a big fan of his. But I really had a lot of respect for him. He became an attorney. He was a color commentator during the Miracle on Ice and all that with Al Michaels. Right. And the thing is that he said that he played, I think, for Cornell.
When
they played for Cornell, he played at the Boston Garden a lot. So then that first year that they brought him up, and they threw him sort of like, it was like a Hail Mary. They threw him against the Bruins. He was brand new. And he said he really liked playing at the Boston Garden. He liked the lighting. He felt comfortable there. And then
I didn't know that.
Once he got on a roll and he started frustrating the Bruins, you know how it is in sports. Once the snowball starts going down the hill, sometimes you can't stop it.
It was like Superman in the net against the Bruins. And I'd just like to make a comment about Don Cherry when he was with the Bruins. I thought he was a great coach.
Oh, me too.
And Harry Sidden, I believe, you know, he thought he was too popular or something. And all of a sudden, he just kicked him out and fired him as a Bruins coach. I thought he was terrific, as well as a great personality.
Yeah, absolutely. And that team in the late 70s, they called them the Lunch Pail Group. They had a lot of talent, but Don Cherry had them playing like that blue-collar style of hockey, and they would try to go against Montreal, which was all finesse.
The forechecking and all that stuff, just tenacious teams. Anyway, I just wanted to make a comment about that.
All right.
Well, have a nice morning.
Yeah, thank you. Call again. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. How you doing, Paul?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, condolences to Steve Gasper.
Yeah. That was a real shocker.
Yeah, yeah. I had experience with him back in the 70s when there was an adult summer league going on in the city. Highly competitive. And Steve Gasper, he was such a pure shooter. Unbelievable. He was like JoJo White, you know, but always in the clutch moments also, you know. And I looked at that. He was like a league above everybody else kind of thing.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I didn't know him very well. I knew him a little bit, broadcasting games locally and all that. And actually, I announced the game, the Dartmouth High School game for Dartmouth Community Media, the night that they named the court after him. And we interviewed him, I think, at halftime. And, you know, I covered him back in the old Channel 13 days and everything else. And he was always really affable, always really classy guy. And then when you talk to people in the community about him, I don't think I've ever heard a bad word about the guy. Everybody always thought he was a great guy.
Yeah, he was sort of like a consummate pro kind of attitude about him. And actually, you know, prior to him playing with us in summer league, yeah, he had a reputation already of having all that. So great human being. The world would be a little bit less without him in it. That'd be one thing. The other thing I wanted to talk about just real quickly was the Powerball situation. Mm-hmm. And as you know, both Powerball and Mega Millions started out at $1, and they went to $2. And Mega Millions made a huge mistake and went to $5 because they weren't offering anything in addition to the regular play. This is an idea that I had. Maybe we can get the Powerball people, if they're going to go to $5, and eventually I think they will, to set up the situation where everything after $500 million is not taxable. Then I think people will be willing to pay the $5. What do you think of that idea?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. I'm not a gambler myself. And I think some of these prizes, though, you know, aren't they a little outrageous? I mean, how much money do you need? I mean, I'd rather see 100 people get $1 million than one person get $100 million, you know?
Yeah, 60.
But that's cool, just buddy. Me. Yeah. All right. Hey, bye. Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. Bye.
All right, if you're on the line, please hang on. One more break, and then you'll be on here at WBSM. We'll be right back.
And the challenges of every day.
A challenge Steve Gaspar gladly accepted for 41 years. Today we honor him for his many achievements with the naming of the basketball court.
Yeah, just a great guy, Steve Gaspar. Again, our condolences go out to the Gaspar family. Just a terrific gentleman. Him, his wife, involved in the After Prom program. The impact as an educator. Do you have somebody that, you know, had an impact on you? We also heard on the news that the hockey world, totally different, but similar in a way, Ken Dryden, the great Montreal goaltender who tortured the Bruins for many years, he passed away at the age of 78. So Ken Dryden at 78 and locally Steve Gasper at the age of 74. So, you know, it's just sad to see these legends pass on. And of course, Steve at 74 is not old by today's standards at all. So to have him pass so suddenly, we were just so sorry to hear that. And then we were taking a trip down memory lane. All kinds of people were calling about street hockey games that we used to play as kids. Wow, that's definitely different. Back in the day, pickup games were the norm, and that's something that you really don't see anymore. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, I just joined this conversation a little too late, but I couldn't let it go by without a shout-out about the Peckham Street Penguins.
The Peckham Street Penguins.
That was our hockey team. and David Dennis Jamavel was on that team. George LaHere.
Ooh.
We grew up in a great neighborhood in the Reynolds Street, Peckham Street area, in Myrtle Street. And we used to play at Knapp Shoe, Mount Pleasant School, and the old Knowlton School.
Yeah, we did too. We used to play on dead-end streets up in the northwest end of New Bedford, kind of like the neighborhood south of the Riccardi's, a restaurant there in Hathaway Road, through there, Gardner Street, Lantern Lane, Pamela Drive. And, you know, we would have pickup games, baseball, hockey. And when the Big Bad Bruins took over in the early 70s, we went from baseball over to hockey. And like we said, we just go and buy like a baseball glove at Kmart. And you get like a little ball, and then they came out with a puck with the little rollers on them, and you just found a way. You used the, whether it was couch cushions or, you know, pillows from your bed, you were able to slap together, you know, an outfit that purported to be a goaltender outfit, and you just made it work. You know, that's just the way it was.
it was a great time to be a kid, and the Bruins certainly are responsible for a big amount of money spent in this area on hockey equipment. There's no doubt.
You know what was great about it, too, is I wasn't very athletic. My brother was very athletic, but I wasn't. But, you know, with a neighborhood, you'd have a game with, like, 20 kids involved. No matter where you were, you know what I mean? I was sort of like at the bottom of the pecking order, but regardless of who you were, like, you still ended up on a team. You still have the baseball bat, and you'd have your hands go. You take the two best players, and they'd keep alternating. I used to get picked at the end, but I didn't care because I was just so happy to be playing, you know?
Hey, we used to even play ice hockey on the two ponds that were behind U.S. Furniture on Sawyer Street.
Oh, yeah. You know, there was a pond off of where Hidden Brook is now. It used to be Rockdale West. That was all woods back there, and there used to be a pond back there. And, yeah, kids used to play ice hockey back there on the pond. You're right.
It was a great time to be alive, man.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right. Well, thank you.
Have a good day, Paul.
All right. This conversation went in a different direction than I thought, which is great. I like it. I like to divert from the politics once in a while. You know, it gets a little tiring, especially on a Saturday morning. The reason why we're talking about, you know, sandlot games and street hockey games is because not only did we lose a great gentleman in the community, town of Dartmouth, Steve Gaspar, coach, player, leader, somebody, of course, is an educator, and he passed away at the age of 74. Again, condolences to the family. But then we just heard on the news that Ken Dryden, the great Montreal Canadiens goaltender, passed away at the age of 78. So then one thing led to another, and it's like, oh, don't you remember the sandlot games? Oh, don't you remember the street hockey games? Oh, don't you remember how it was back in the day? If you have a memory, lines are open right now, 508-996-0500. Yeah, we used to be able to get a pickup game in about 5 minutes. I got to tell you, I wasn't very athletic. In fact, I had rheumatoid arthritis pretty bad, so I could play a little bit, but I wasn't a great athlete or anything like that. But it didn't matter. You took the two best players. They would pick a team. You'd alternate. I usually get picked at the end. But then there was one game in particular where I'm playing this game, and I stink, right? But, you know, I'm just, you know, kind of, you know, running around there. And, you know, the two best players are going back and forth. And then one day I get the puck, and I went in, and I took this shot, and I actually got the game-winning goal. And I thought I was like the cock of the walk, so to speak, you know. So those things happen. Even if you're a weaker player, you participated. You know, they wanted you to participate. It's not like the better players didn't want you to play. As long as each team had good players and each team had the younger players or the players weren't that good, you made it work. And then if there was a controversy, I think that's one of the things that was different too back then. If there was a controversy, remember the old take it over? You know, if you're playing a baseball game, it's like he was safe. No, he was out. No, he was safe. No, he was out. All right, take it over. You know, so there was conflict resolution back then. You know what I mean? You had to figure it out. You had to work it out. And that's just the way it was. That was a great time, though. It was a great time to grow up and, you know, great time to be alive. And we just had great childhoods back then. But anyway, do you have any memories of that? Do you have any memories of Steve Gaspar? Do you have a particular coach or a particular, you know, say, educator, particular teacher that had a big impact on you? We do have time to sneak you in the last 5 minutes here. Now let's go straight to this caller directly. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
I got a couple old memories.
Uh-oh.
I'm an old guy. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Go ahead.
All right. I go back to the early 50s and 60s, and I had a nephew that I used to pick up sides because I was the older guy, you know. So all the kids in the neighborhood would come out when they saw me, and I would pitch for both sides. Mm-hmm. And the only one that threw the ball to me without rolling it in was my nephew. So I had this coach. He was the coach of the, I can't think of the name of it right now. And he would line drive the ball to me when he was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, whoa, this kid's got a cannon. So I had this customer that used to come in all the time named John Pedro, if you ever heard of him.
No.
Anyway, I kept telling him about this kid, and he says, Bob, I hear this crap all the time. So I said, well, you'll see. He was 8 years old. He was an all-star everything, and his name was Tommy Toyfair.
Tommy Toyfair. That name sounds familiar.
Yeah, he pitched quite a few no-hitters for New Bedford High and several for, what's the other team? I can't think of.
Oh, the Post One, maybe. Post One, the Legion team?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he won several other games over there.
Well, see, it all started then, before he even got to high school. See, it all started there in the Sandlot games.
And he was a superstar in high school, too.
Yeah.
And he signed with the Philadelphia Phillies.
That's great. That's great. That's a great story.
The only thing wrong with that is that when you sign for peanuts, they treat you like just another number, like part of the cattle, you know?
Mm-hmm. And back then, I think they didn't treat those younger players as good as they do now, you know?
No. So he got disgusted with it because he said the politics were incredible. You know, the guys that signed for big bucks, those are the ones they push up front.
Right.
And the ones that signed for peanuts, they would just be another number, you know?
Yeah. All right, so, great story. Thank you very much for calling. Call again.
I got one more.
Oh, go ahead, real quick. We're running out of time.
Jim Casey.
Oh, Jim Casey.
Yeah.
Crazy Casey from my TV show.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I've known him for a long time, and he was a pretty good catcher in the Bedford High.
Right, and then I know he ended up playing first base after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. Have a great weekend.
All right. You too.
All right. And speaking of Crazy Casey, my television show will be on tomorrow morning at 11:30, a new time after the Catholic Mass. They tell me that more people are watching at 11:30 because you kind of lead into football and all that. So, okay, we'll take that time slot, 11:30 a.m. after the Catholic Mass. It's called the Paul Santos Live Show. Again, I don't think they have the name of my show up there. I don't know why they're having trouble with that lately. But anyway, we have some great guests. We have Ed Fonseca and Larry Ferreira from Eddie and the Exciters. I know you know Eddie and the Exciters because they played at 50s Night and they're well known throughout the community. They're on the show. Terrific. Casey McNeil, a comic. Maureen McCormick, a comic. We have Ron Caldair, Melissa Whitley, and Artie DeMello. Great sax player, the PSL band. We have my sidekick, Joanna Raposo, who lines up all the comedians. And last but not least, as that caller just mentioned, Jim Crazy Casey, who usually comes on at the end and does his old Foster Brooks routine. So tomorrow morning, 11:30, ABC 6. By the way, next Saturday morning, I'm going to have as my guest during the 8 o'clock hour, Seth Aiken.